You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to this episode of the Disease du Jour podcast. I'm your host, Carly Sisson, and in this episode, I spoke with Dr. Chelsea Ludke about diagnosing and managing gastric ulcers in horses. This episode of Disease du Jour is brought to you by Bimeda. Dr. Ludke is a veterinarian with a passion for equine sports medicine, holistic therapies, and helping animals and their humans navigate complex care with compassion. With bachelor's degrees in biochemistry and microbiology, a master's, and her DVM, all from Colorado State University, her academic and clinical background runs deep. She completed a competitive internship at Piedmont Equine Practice in Virginia, and later worked at a high-volume clinic in Wisconsin before returning to Colorado, where she and her husband now own and operate Heritage Equine Clinic. A certified veterinary acupuncturist, she continues to explore integrative approaches to animal care. When she's not seeing patients, you'll find her at the barn with her family or on the mic co-hosting the Unhinged and On Call podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Bimeda, the manufacturer of GastroBim. GastroBim, omeprazole, is the first and only FDA-approved bioequivalent to GastroGuard. Give your horse a scientifically proven, apple-flavored solution for gastric ulcers. Because equine gastric ulcer syndrome is complex, always work with your veterinarian for proper diagnosis and care. Same trusted treatment, less cost. That's GastroBim. The safety of GastroBim paste has not been determined in pregnant or lactating mares. For use in horses and foals 4 weeks of age and older. To get us started, what does the current evidence tell us about the prevalence of gastric ulcers in horses?
Yeah, I was just reading up on it because my practice is primarily sport horses. And so I just wanted to kind of refresh myself with numbers. But for sure on the prevalence in racetrack and standardbred, so thoroughbred and standardbred racing, is upwards of 80 to 100% of them on gastroscopy show squamous lesions, with glandular in that cross-section of horses being a lot less glandular disease. So in the prevalence-wise, you're kind of actually sitting a little bit higher than 50% glandular in sport horses. And that is, they kind of characterize it as horses in intense levels of work. So upper level eventers, endurance horses, dressage, and high level jumpers. And what is kind of resounding with the glandular disease horses is it's the intensity of work that they're under, more than even the time that they're training. So you could be fitness training a horse at a lower intensity for longer periods of time and have less prevalence of glandular disease. But there's, of course, still squamous lesions that we pick up in sport horses as well. So that was kind of sitting around like 40 to 50% with what they were finding in terms. So pretty high when you consider the cross-section of horses. And I think it matches in my practice, like pleasure horses and things like that. We don't often get the chance or the inclination to scope those horses, but their prevalence is a lot less, you know, like I would say under 20%, I think is what the review I was reading was, is the evidence showing that consistent turnout and forage, access to forage, and lower stress in terms of not showing, not traveling, is huge in horses, right? And so then your prevalence of gastric disease is quite a bit lower.
Yeah. Can you explain what the main difference is between squamous and glandular ulcers?
Yeah, that's a great question. So essentially we have the basics of the equine stomach, right? Or that we have two types of mucosa in the stomach. We have squamous mucosa on the top half, essentially, and then glandular on the bottom half. And that junction everyone refers to as a margo placatus is your most kind of like highest density of having squamous lesions are going to be on the margo. And you do, of course, see ulcium up above the margo on the lesser curvature. It's basically areas where there's more acid contact. And so that's the biggest thing with squamous lesions is going to be your acid contact. And we know that horses are very acidic compared to humans, like their pH is in the twos resting, especially after a starch meal. So if you think about thoroughbreds on the racetrack having high concentrate diets, we know that the pH drops considerably for an hour or two after high starch diets. horses, of course, pleasure horses wouldn't be having a lot of concentrates, if any. And so they tend to have a pretty consistent pH. What we see with glandular is going to be anything in that darker pink mucosa, so bottom half of stomach, and then even kind of passing into that pyloric antrum. So the outflow tract of the stomach, you can get glandular ulcers anywhere in there. And those tend to be different causes. So we're thinking a disruption of the mucosal barrier. So that's why a lot of times we'll use prostaglandin analogs to help create a better mucus layer. We know for sure that our non-steroidals cut into that mucosal production, specifically in the glandular mucosa. But in terms of me explaining it to a client, I'll just kind of break it down. And the great thing about gastroscopy is they see it. And so you can explain, okay, squamous is this lighter pink mucosa, glandular is dark pink. They have different reasons. The glandular mucosa is supposed to be in acid contact most of the time. However, the squamous is not. And so I do pull up, there's some really good videos of their exercise gastroscopy videos. And I like to show clients how the acid contact happens if they're unfed, like say that they're working. And what's nice about those videos is they have them separated out to a trot video where they're on a treadmill, a high speed. And so they get a little bit of acid contact and sloshing at the trot, minimal at the walk. And then at the canter and even into the gallop, it's like just unfed. It's a washing machine of acid hitting the squamous mucosa, and it shouldn't be up there. And so, and then they have the fed horses as well, which is really helpful for clients to see that fiber mat of what hay and forage should be sitting in their stomach. And so I think that's really helpful to explain to clients, at least when you're talking through all this, is a lot of people don't know the anatomy of the stomach in terms of horse owners.
Yeah, that's a great point. I know that clinical signs of ulcers can sometimes be vague and nonspecific. So what are some findings or history that would prompt you to recommend gastroscopy for your patients?
Sure. I think it's a great question, because I think when you're in private practice and you don't have a gastroscope available to you to use, I know I used to fall back on like 7-day GastroGuard trials and see how the horse changed. And I would always kind of like guess on the outward appearance of the horse. If they were hard to maintain weight, if they were jittery and anxious a lot, for sure if they were girthy, but there's a lot of horses, as it turns out, that are girthy and don't have gastric ulcers. And then after having a scope, like I am pretty open to clients now, and I'll say, I have a suspicion, like, and I will say most of it is client driven, because they're like, can we just scope and see if they have ulcers? I'm in a location in Denver area where most people are keen to get diagnostics and imaging, and so it works out well. I no longer tell people that I can predict very well what kind of ulcers we're going to find, because I do feel like the clinical signs are so variable. One of them, I think that's kind of a mainstay, is if I have a horse that's recurrently mildly colicky, and especially the ones that like to stretch out and they don't eat their grain, but they eat their hay, I can almost bank on those ones being a squamous, like having some sort of squamous disease. But then my glandular ones, they will, I would say, like a broad array of either they colic with bute or banamine, like post a day or two later. For one instance, I was treating a cellulitis, and then by day 3, the horse was colicky, and we scoped it, and its glandular mucosa was really irritated and mad. And so that's one kind of great way to find out in a in a roundabout fashion. But then I would say my ridden horses, a lot of them will say essentially don't want to move off the leg. They're especially pissy about the right leg. So if they're riding dressage and they're really trying to get them to bend off the right leg, then the horse is pissier than if they're putting their left leg on. But girthiness is not, I don't think it's linear. I have a lot of horses that have muscular pain in that region, but you'll scope them and it's a negative scope. So everything looks normal. So it's just hard, but I will pretty openly tell clients now, I'm like, I don't have a good idea. Like if I was a betting person, I would not bet on me being able to tell from the outside of the horse what I'm going to find on the scope anymore, because it's all over the map.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like the girthiness one, you hear all the time, people suspect that's ulcers, but not necessarily realizing that there are a range of issues that can make the horse girthy.
Yeah. Yes, correct. And yeah, a lot of different reasons. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you find that horses often have both squamous and glandular disease?
I would probably I was trying to think of my practice, but probably like 30% of them, I would say, have a combined And it is hard. It's like that chicken and the egg. Okay, did one of them come on first? And, you know, the other one secondary causes stress. I think in the last 2 to 3 years, with a lot of the research just coming out, and especially Dr. Benjamin Sykes' work, is now we're, and it's, I think it's quite, I guess, progressive and good, is that now if I'm seeing combined or really even just severe disease of any sort, I'm looking elsewhere in the body. I do have, in a very small subset, I have a handful of horses, like less than 5, that just get squamous ulcers. And we've had advanced diagnostics throughout the horse and a lot of track record, like years and years of the horse performing. And we find nothing like musculoskeletal, nothing respiratory, nothing. I've had a couple that have been like ophthalmic related. I mean, there's things you do have to make sure you're looking at the whole horse. I have one quick story of a horse that probably 4.5 years ago, we kept treating because it was literally, it would chase its tail. It'd go squamous, and then our rescope would be gas or glandular, and we'd rescope and then be back to squamous. It turned out, and I was very bummed in my skill set at the time, is I never did like a ridden exam on the mare. We could lunge her, and I did basically miss work on her inflections. I never heard her in a bridle, and it turns out she was like a grade 4 laryngeal paralysis. And I don't, the trainers, I work with them, I still work with them, and they know Aurora, just nobody told me, nobody put that together. As soon as we did a tie back on the mare, and the ulcers didn't come back. So here this mare was like jumping meter 10, like with a junior, and it literally, we were chasing our tail with ulcers. I think we probably scoped her 8 times in treating different fashions, and luckily she was insured, so it was mostly getting paid for. And here there was very much a primary issue. So I think that's just what I would urge everyone to think about, is making sure you're considering the whole body, especially on these ones that are mixed squamous and glandular.
Yeah. And
I just think you have to consider even your NSAID use. I do have some on Equiox that still get glandular disease. So I think it's important when you have both, you've got to treat both, of course, but then still try to piece together, okay, how did it get this bad? How do we move forward in a preventive manner?
Yeah. Do you have any tips for performing and interpreting gastroscopy, especially when you're evaluating the glandular mucosa, which I know can be a little bit more difficult to visualize?
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely a steep learning curve for gastroscopes, because I think one of our, this is universal, I'm pretty sure, but I think one of our biggest nemesis, right, is nosebleeds. When you're, it can be, you know, we have so many that it's like a 15 minute start to finish. You see everything, check esophagus on the way out. You know, you're doing a full exam, and then right at the end, the horse moves, or, you know, and you hit an ethmoid or something like that, and all of a sudden you're there. I don't like leaving horses actively bleeding, so you're there for 45 minutes, and, you know, sedated horse, you finish, and they get lower and lower head. You've got to hold it up. So I do, we learned over time, I'll share some of that now, but it was definitely, don't feel bad, just keep at it. The biggest thing I think we did in our areas is we're close to Colorado State University. And so we had one of the internal medicine residents, essentially, they're able to do kind of field work and stuff like that at different times. And they were so nice, and they're offering like, okay, let us help you, you know, sort it out. We have basically 3 doctors that we hadn't gastroscoped a horse since our internships. And at that point, with 3 meter scopes, we had a hard time getting to the pylorus and a fair number of horses. So when we finally did order, we ordered a 3.5 meter scope. And that makes all the difference in the world in getting to the pylorus on every horse. We have a lot of warm bloods and large warm bloods in our practice. And like just yesterday, I was into the duodenum on an average sized eventer. And I still had like 0.5 meter of scope. So running out of scope length is not fun. It is trickier to find biopsy equipment, of course, so you have to keep that in mind. But the 3.5 meter makes all the difference in the world. So if you are working with a 3 meter, obviously you have to work with what you have. But if you're ordering something, I would look for a 3.5. The biggest thing in my mind, of course, is proper patient restraint, right? I start most horses with 5 milligrams of dormosidan. So I am somewhat left-sided. I try to do both. We find that, so obviously lighter than that, they're shaking their head and moving, increases your chance of nosebleeds. more than that, I feel like they have a much more delayed swallow reflex. And so then you have, of course, everyone worries, but you have a chance of when you're trying to get them to swallow, it's not as easy as an NG tube. It's just smaller and a little bit more flexible, right? You have a chance of getting into the oral cavity. So we have some, I know some practices will actually put on an oral speculum first and have them open, but you can get the end of your endoscope chomped pretty easily, pushing through and trying to get when they're not on a swallow. And so that's a really obviously a sad mistake because it takes your scope out for several weeks and it's just expensive to repair and it can happen in an instant. So I will say in our practice, our techs drive the scope, our DVMs pass, because I think it's just part of it is part like feel and knowing that you can potentially take a turn under that soft palate and be an oral cavity. We have an integrated water and actually it's water, air, and suction setup. And that I really find in the hand pumping model, right, of all of this, it just takes a while. So if you're patient and the horse is being good and properly restrained, then of course you can use a hand pump. Our system, we've had a couple different pumps within this kind of integrated system. But the biggest thing to me in getting a really good view is obviously good emptying. So we're usually on an 18-hour fast. So essentially I have owners remove feed. They can allow access to water, but remove feed around 4 or 5 p.m. 18 hours brings us to about 9 a.m. And then older horses tend to empty slower. So I don't necessarily go above 18, but if they're not empty on my first scope, I'll do a 20 or 22 hour. It's just the horses don't mind it as much as the clients do, right? It's not, the fasting is not that hard, but you will get pushback. So you just have to you just say, okay, this is the only way to get the empty stomach to see the pylorus. And most people understand that. The biggest thing is when you're working with an empty stomach is your air inflation. And then of course we remove the air before we leave. But I find that once your stomach is inflated enough, you can get through that cardia. Look at the whole squamous. For me, it's whole squamous mucosa. You need enough air to get the entirety of your margot above the fluid line if you're allowing water overnight. Of course you can suction, but it just gets messy. I do know some practices that don't allow water overnight. I don't love that idea. So the biggest thing on the pylorus, I tend to just let my scope follow a greater curvature and then come up and do your 180. Once you can see that little window underneath your lesser curvature, so you'll kind of come around full circle, see yourself at the cardia and pop up and under. So it's almost, I'd say probably a 120 to 180 degree approach. I don't even try, if you've got a fluid layer in your pylorus or the pathway into the pylorus. If you can't see a space, I don't try to drive in there. Because what happens as soon as you hit the fluid level is you fall to the ventral aspect of the stomach. And then you're just in mucosal folds and you're swimming. Like that doesn't, in my mind, every once in a while, try to push through. And sometimes you get lucky and you pop up. But I won't even pass the scope into that lesser curvature area until I can actually see the opening into the pylorus. And then what I'll do is I kind of sit there for maybe a minute or two. Horses don't tend to mind all this part of it once you're through the laryngeal area. Is we don't have air going by then. We're just watching the pylorus. So I watch that it contracts fully. And that gives you a sense, contracted and open, of if there's any polypoid type lesions. Sometimes you just have those stripes, the red and vertical stripes. I don't get super upset about those. I've tracked a lot of horses and some of them just have that variation, but I would not treat for that, those vertical stripes. I tend to only do I tend to see the more raised lesions and edematous lesions in the pylorus. I do know you can have depressed lesions in the pylorus, but I don't tend to see those as much. And then of course, if I'm tracking a horse or I do see a polypoid lesion, we're either doing a biopsy or, we have it on repetitive scopes and we know that that is a polyp. You're not treating essentially a true, you're not going to get that to resolve with prostaglandin analogs or sucralfate.
Awesome. Well, those are some great tips. Hopefully those will be useful to anyone who's less comfortable performing as they. Once you've gone through this process, you've made your diagnosis, how do you start to approach treatment for squamous versus glandular disease or for horses that have both?
Sure. I will just start with squamous specifically. I'll do, if you're at day zero, we'll start GastroGuard full tube. I find with your grades. We can go over those quickly, but the grade one being hyperkeratosis, I won't necessarily, even a little bit of gastritis, unless the horse has a lot of clinical signs, I won't treat just for a grade one, like the hyperkeratosis, that yellowing that you see on the stomach. If it's globally on the lower part of squamous mucosa, then I may do like 14 days of full tube GastroGuard, but I don't necessarily rescope. I would go based on how the horse is feeling after that. Your grade two, so your superficial squamous lesions, singles or multiples, but all superficial. That still falls into 28 days of GastroGuard for me, depending on their weight, of course, too. So some of these horses, you have to remember, are at 1,600 pounds, and the dose goes up to 1,250. So you do have to consider the animal you're treating and kind of know that. For sure, grade three and fours, the more deep and cavitated or bleeding lesions or extensive in number, then I 100% will do 28 days rescope, and some of those need a full 56 days. The most important thing about GastroGuard, because I get a lot of people wanting compounds for omeprazole and trying esomeprazole and all the other like different varieties that are out there, is I assure them, I'm like, you can technically use whatever you want. I work on a lot of insured horses, so I stick with GastroGuard, but I do have clients that will try something essentially compounded or whatever. And I'm like, but you have to rescope. You cannot bank on those products fixing your horse or healing your horse for any amount of time. I think it does make horses feel better enough with, there's probably some pH increase, but what we know with squamous ulcers is we need a pH above 6 for 28 days essentially to heal ulcers. And so there are some non-responders. I find them very minimally, but we will test a pH on a 28-day GastroGuard horse. So I make sure that they're still currently on the GastroGuard. There is a smaller window. Like I think it's better acknowledged now, but omeprazole does not work with acid suppression for 24 hours. Like your kind of average 16 to 18 hours of acid suppression. And so we do have a little bit of breakthrough. So there's some horses that I think it was Benjamin Sykes at last year's AAP was talking about mixing in sucralfate at that 18-hour mark. If they're refractory and not healing at your 28-day scope, then you can start to employ some different approaches. But the biggest thing with your pH testing is knowing that the horse has gotten it really within the last like 14 to 16 hours of full tube, and make sure that their pH is at an appropriate level. And I'm surprised, it may be a pH of 4 for healing, I should know that. But you'd be surprised, a lot of those horses are like 6.5. They're almost neutral pH. So it is very effective. The number one thing that I coach people and clients through is making sure it's on an empty stomach. But I don't know, probably 8 years ago, that wasn't as well known, but it for sure is known in human medicine, is that it should be on an empty stomach, has to make it all the way into duodenum and small intestine, right, to get absorbed as a proton pump inhibitor. And so that whole cycle won't work if you give it recently fed. So I tell people, of course, it's 30 to 60 minutes before a feeding. I have a lot of barns that get six or seven feedings a day with dressage horses. And so I kind of require them to do the morning feeding, because there's almost no way you can guarantee an empty stomach in that. But the biggest thing is for the more significant ones, I'm doing a rescope at 28 days to make sure that they're either healing or fully healed. And that drives, of course, future decisions. If you're guessing 6 months down the road if they healed or not, it's not a great place to be. I often rescope horses. I don't necessarily just leave it up to chance. When you get into glandular ones, specifically at the pylorus for me is kind of the most common. There are some glandular just below Margo placatus that I treat. I find that most horses, as long as they're not actively colicking and doing really poorly, do fine with starting misoprostol as a prostaglandin analog. I get some cramping in mares that you have to be careful with, but I generally do 21 to 28 days of misoprostol, depending on the severity. I have some that will have really mild, like edematous lesions, and I might do 14 days, but that's usually on a combined, if I'm already treating GastroGuard on the squamous side. I will, if I just find glandular alone, I will just do a short sucralfate dose in the beginning. I find that for a lot of boarding farms, like truly 4 times a day is almost, that means an overnight treatment. And in that scenario, I'm doing risk versus benefit, and I do 3 times a day, and I'll maybe do 5 to 7 days worth if they're actually like actively feeling poor undersaddle or having like major performance issues or of course colic, then we'll do sucralfate and have them give. So many clients want to give it in food. So you just have to coach people through the fact that it is just going to bind to whatever food. The time has shortened up, which is nice. It used to be 30 minutes from food and other medications. I think the last I heard is we could potentially be doing 5 to 10 minutes separate from food and other medications, but it does need to be given, in my opinion, soaked to make a paste and given that way. So I will, those are kind of my three mainstays that I'll use in a combination, I don't know, depending on the horse, I guess.
Yeah. And if you're treating with all three, they need to be spaced out to administration of them. Right.
Yes. Yeah. That is really hard.
Yeah.
It's like, and so we will, I'll make up charts for like, if we have a pretty significant case, I'll make up a chart with the times of what they need to be doing, because each barn is different with their feeding times, and make sure that the people understand, okay, I give GastroGuard first, like the earliest thing seems to work the best, sucralfate like 2 hours later, and then space out the sucralfate for them and try to come to like a kind of a mutually beneficial thing that gets the meds in the horse. But I am fairly aware about just timing of barns. Like you can't have people doing excessive amounts unless the horse absolutely needs it, in my opinion. Like I do think there's a lot of extra medications that are given sometimes that don't need to be given. And I keep that short. If it is going to be all three medications, I keep it fairly short.
Yeah. How do you approach tapering treatment, and do you worry at all about any rebound effects?
I do. I think like the initial rebound effect, we were doing much longer. We were doing like 14 days of half tube, and sometimes I'll go to quarter tube. I think the more recent research has shown that that rebound is pretty short lived. So I'll do 3 to 5 days now of half tube. And then only on a sensitive horse would go half to quarter. Like I feel like at that stage, they're probably doing fine. I don't know if this is correct or not. I don't necessarily taper misoprostol. And so I don't find that most horses, you know, we're dealing with a much different process there with the mucosal barrier. So I don't find that horses need a taper on that. What I will keep on some really sensitive horses, especially those dressage horses, is that are in a fair amount of work, I'll keep sucralfate pre-rides. I really think, whether it's placebo, I don't know. I do think horses feel better with sucralfate pre-ride, which is hard because I also want them fed. And so then I'll have them do sucralfate, or sorry, feeding maybe an hour pre-ride if they can, if the timing is appropriate, and half a flake, and then half an hour pre-ride, up to 45 minutes pre-ride, I'd do some sucralfate, but try to keep those at least like 20 minutes apart, which in some instances, those, you know, the owners are totally willing to do that. I think there is a cycle. We're learning more about management and how we get these horses to tolerate some gastric pain. I think asking them to do that with work and sloshing and a girth and a rider squeezing their sides of their chest and all that is not super fair. So I think if you can also break into that mental aspect of, oh, this is going to hurt, I don't want to move forward, I think it helps to have that sucralfate pre-ride.
Yeah, that's a great tip. Where do newer therapies like extended release fit into the current treatment recommendations?
Yeah, I think I've definitely been hearing a lot about them. I've used them in a select few cases where like daily administration of omeprazole was going to be too difficult. This is 3 to 4 years ago. I had quite resounding reactions. One of them was on my own horse because I was trying to be lazy and not get out to the barn every day. I'm bored. And so I was trying to not require, you know, the barn manager and all that to give the medications at a certain time. And I used it on my own horse. And after one use with him, I didn't finish. I recently looked back into the product, I think that just got launched, but they're not labeled FDA. I work on a lot. Like I know that GastroGuard works in my population of horses. They're all good for oral meds. Most horses don't tend to mind GastroGuard with the taste and the volume's not too big. It's not that hard to give. In fact, I have a lot of horses with squamous disease that learn to take their syringes very well because I think they know that they feel better after. And so I haven't messed around with it in the last year or two. And in the last cost estimate, I had a rep reaching out a few months ago is when you think about by the time you charge the client, I want to say it was in the 200 range, our cost per week, but it's no cost savings. And then you're going off label. And if you have a massive reaction like that, I don't think it's worth the daily savings, I guess, of your time. I don't know. But yeah, it is hard. I know, like, especially a 56 day treatment, it is hard. But most of our firms, somebody's, of course, they're there. You know, you just have to work out scheduling.
Yeah, I've been in that position before, driving out to my barn every morning an hour before feeding to get my horse ulcer medication. But, you know, it's worth it in the end.
Right. It's not easy, but you can get it done. Yeah.
Are there any unanswered questions or emerging research about ulcers that you want to highlight before we wrap up today?
I think the one resounding thing to me that I've been, I guess, happy to share with clients is there was a white paper, I want to say it was last year from ACVIM, but talking about management of glandular disease and prevention. And one of the big things is if there is a gastric microbiome, right? It's, of course, much different than a colonic microbiome in terms of what flora and commensals are in there. But one resounding thing that sticks out to me is that we are in this, like, very supplement heavy type of management for horses. And so I do counsel people through the fact that we a lot of times have to streamline and eliminate extra things in their diet. Like, horses are supposed to be on forage, and a lot of times their forage doesn't have enough protein. So I do, in a general sense, it's a ration balancer, it's forage, and it's vitamin E. Then when you start adding in intense exercise, right, you need to add a little bit more concentrate or flake alfalfa, things like that. I think the biggest question I get from people is prevention, and in a recurring sense, right, because we know these horses that are at risk tend to recur with squamous or glandular, is try not to oversupplement and be giving 18 million different things. And it's even in my own horses, I find that for a while I'll be like, okay, these are my core three things, like a ration balancer, sometimes a top line amino acid source, and a vitamin E. And then maybe 6 months in, I'll have added two or three different things. And I'm like, what am I doing? Like, just simplify. I think in general, you know, horse owners like to buy supplements for every little thing. So making sure that you go through diet, it takes time. As veterinarians, we're not nutritionists, or most of us are not. Either find someone to consult with nutritionally, but make sure that we're not adding in a lot of, like, I have some that feed really, like, pretty raw herbals. And I tell them, I'm like, I'm not quite sure. Like, if I take some vitamins on an empty stomach, they're like, I don't feel good sometimes. And so you do that on a daily manner, and we, you know, horses can't tell us, like, you are risking some things. So I try to keep things simple when I can, because prevention is the best method, right? So we're learning more and more about how to manage glandular disease, even though it's still really, there's a lot of unknowns. I think it's important that we at least address what horses are eating, right? Because that's probably, on top of stress, that's probably one of the more important things, is what goes through their gastric system. So,
yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Lukey, for joining us today and talking about ulcers.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. Thank you so much again, Dr. Lukey, for joining us on this episode. And thank you to Bimeda for supporting the podcast. And of course, thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to Disease Du Jour. If you have any questions or suggestions, please email me at csisson@equinenetwork.com.